Tonight, we have Dave and Chris continuing their presentation of the original manuscript. And there is a solution.
This sounds about right.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Thank you.
Hey everyone, my name is David Potter. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic.
Hey,
all right. So, we're winding up in the original manuscript with "There is a solution," and it comes from the tale of an adequate description of what has ailed me as an alcoholic. We're on 25.1, I believe. You should see a paragraph there that says "There is a solution." Everybody have a book? Everybody who have a book, who wants a book? There are books over. Are they all out, Chris?
No. We have books.
Page 25. There is a solution. So it starts off with, "There is a solution. Almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings, which the process requires for its successful consummation. But we saw that it really worked in others, and we had to come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living it. When therefore we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. We have found much of heaven, and we've been rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed." There is a lot in that paragraph. It ends with a promise about being rocketed into the fourth dimension, which I personally had a resentment against. Anybody have a resentment against other people who are in the fourth dimension? That just seems like, you know, you got to be something special. And I was never special. I was always the kid on the edge of the dance floor, and I was always awkward. And I'm not going to join that group. You know, and I had people would say, "I'm rocketed," and I'd be like, "Yeah, you bet you are, you moron." But I didn't think I could ever get there. You know, and here I am reading spiritual literature thinking, you guys think you're special. But there's a lot more to that paragraph, and I want to talk a little bit about that. It starts off with a description of what we're going to go through, right? The self-searching, right? That's the inventory, the leveling of our pride, right? That's in 5 and 6, and the confession of shortcomings in 5 requires for the successful consummation. That's also a promise. I am not going to be able to do this on my own, and this is the theme of everything that I've been given up until this point. The successful consummation is going to come after I do things that I've never done before, and it's a promise of a successful consummation. It's not this, you know, it works for some of us. It promises me that it's going to work, and it's going to work for me. There are some simple things that I need to do, and when the evidence of my life comes and hits me square in the face that I've got this problem with alcohol that I cannot seem for left to my own devices to give you any sort of idea what's going to happen when I drink, because when I start drinking, I really don't know, right? And the fact that when I'm separated from alcohol, I end up drinking again, even though I know it's not a good idea, but at the time it seems like a wonderful idea. It seems like the only answer to what's ailing me. I'm going to be given a kit of spiritual tools. Who here thinks they know what spiritual tools I'm going to be given? Raise your hand. Don't be shy. I won't pick on you. Jill.
Trust God, clean house, and help others.
Thank you. Trust God, clean house, and help others. Really, it's a very simple process. It's a process that is way too simple for me to think it's going to work. Right? I thought it had to be complicated. I thought I had to have an urge-ectomy or something when I went to rehab, you know? Aren't you going to do something for me? Because I don't seem to be able to do something for me. And I remember sitting in group, one of my great spiritual leaders once described it as a bad Bob Newhart session, you know? And I remember sitting in the circle going, "I'm not going to make it. These people are going to make it, but I'm not going to. I'm terrified." "I'm okay. Okay." When they asked me, "I'm okay. I'm fine." Right? And I kept thinking, "What are you guys going to do for me? Because I can't do this. I know I'm going to fail walking through that door." You know, if you told me that it simply required me to trust God, well, I'm not going to do that. Right, clean house, what are you talking about? And help others. I'm just, you know, it seems beyond me. But in retrospect, it was the most clear and concise directions I've ever been given. And the final sentence, which I love, "We have been found much of heaven, and we have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed." And I don't know about you guys, some of you sitting here have had the experience slowly. Some of you have had it quickly. Some of you are having it now. I know that I didn't even know what that meant. I thought this was about getting back to some place where I had been previously, where I had found some sort of relief or joy in existence, and that was few and far between. That was a very thin slice of what had actually happened in my life. I, in fact, had just a trudging kind of acceptance that wasn't so painful at periods. I thought that's what I was shooting for. I never realized, probably the truth was, probably not until year 5, did I realize exactly what they were talking about. And all those promises in the 9th step where they talk about new, right? Those were the things that I didn't understand. There was a new experience. There was a new awakening. And this was the existence that I had been given, not because I had the ability to take it, but because I took the idea that I was the problem and that I was in the way and that self was blocking me, and that if I could just do the work to be free of self, I had a chance. And that's what we talk about in Trust God and Clean House, isn't it? Right? And until I was able to get somewhere there, I didn't start to experience what I had never experienced. It was a level of life that I had never experienced. We actually were doing a workshop earlier today, and someone gave a description of the fourth dimension. Does anybody here remember that? Jill. The first dimension being the phenomenon of craving. The second, the mental obsession. The third is the spiritual malady. And the fourth is a conscious contact with God. And I had never heard it put that way, and it suddenly struck me that that's exactly what the fourth dimension of existence was. Free of self and with God. And for me, it rang true. Because that's what had actually happened to me. Not based upon any efforts or abilities that I had, but by just simply accepting the gift that I've been given and doing this work. So anyway, we're not there yet though. The great fact is just this, and nothing less, that we have had a deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and towards God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. So, here's the wrap-up to There Is a Solution. If you're seriously alcoholic, we believe you have no middle-of-the-road solution. You are in a position where life is becoming impossible. And if you have passed into the region for which there is no return through human aid, you have but two alternatives. One is to go to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of your intolerable situation as best you can, and the other, to find what we have found. This you can do if you honestly want to and are willing to make the effort. It's a pretty black and white area, isn't it? There's not a lot of ambiguity there. It doesn't say, well, maybe. Maybe if you change the channel, there'll be a different show on and it'll be okay. I changed all the channels. I had done all the things that I thought could possibly change the outcome of what was happening. And through my absolute best abilities, I had found myself incarcerated in a psychiatric hospital. And the choice at the end of the 30 days was, would you like to go to a drug and alcohol unit, or would you like to go to jail? But I have a half an hour. I had to think about it. I had to think about it. Because the concept that I might actually get sober didn't seem to be realistic for me. Because there didn't seem to be anything inside of me that spoke of hope. I knew that tomorrow was going to be worse than today. And that's the definition of hopelessness for me. I knew that tomorrow could not possibly have been successful. I knew that tomorrow was going to be a failure, because every single day that I had been alive, it had gotten worse, and it had gotten, I'm not alive, but in the last few years of my drinking, it had gotten worse, and things had happened that I had never thought were going to happen, and I had slid down the scale of alcoholism. And faced with this dilemma, you know, to go on to the bitter end or to somehow seek a solution, it was a tough call, it really was. I almost would have wanted oblivion. I almost would, like Bill, you know, I would not have dragged my mattress to the lower floor. That's just not who I am, you know. I would have dragged it closer to the window. You know, anything to end the pain. A certain American businessman had ability, good sense, and high character. For years, he had floundered from one sanitarium to another. He consulted the best-known American psychiatrist. Then he had gone to Europe, placing himself in the care of a celebrated physician who prescribed for him. Though bitter experience had made him skeptical, He finished his treatment with unusual confidence. His physical and mental condition were unusually good. Above all, he believes he had acquired such a profound knowledge of the inner workings of his mind and its hidden springs. Anybody here have an experience that recently in the last few years they're called triggers? I'm not making fun of them, by the way, much, but, you know, the springs of my mind are not the problem, right? My mind is the problem. Anyway, never mind. In the words of his mind and its hidden springs, that relapse was unthinkable. Nevertheless, he was drunk in a short time. More baffling still, he could give himself no satisfactory explanation for his fall. So, did everybody here know who Roland Hazard was? Raise your hand if you've never heard the name Roland Hazard. Don't be embarrassed. All right. So Roland Hazard was the son of an industrialist in the first half of the first quarter of the 20th century in America. The Hazards apparently made their money doing something. I don't know what they made their money doing. You have any idea?
Hazard County down in down Deuce south.
Hazard. Deuce of Hazard. Hazard Signs. That's where we get the name from.
Design factory.
Right. They made widgets. But the Hazards actually had done quite well, and they used to summer up in Vermont. So. Roland actually was, I think, friendly with Eddie, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So Roland was a drinker. He enjoyed his drinking, and Roland had some scrapes of the law, and ended up his family recommended that he, you know, seek psychiatric help, and they ended up going to Europe to see Dr. Carl Jung. Everybody know who Dr. Carl Jung is?
Yeah.
Jung. Jungian psychiatry is different than Freudian psychiatry, and I can't speak to it in any authority. My simple understanding of it is that Freudian asked us to become okay with where we are in this world. And Jungian is that we are more by nature, and we should seek more. So Roland Hazard ends up with Carl Jung, and they spend a year together. In that time, they do a tremendous amount of work, and Roland's not drinking, and he has this unusual confidence. He's a year separated from alcohol. I spent more than a year separated from alcohol. Raise your hand if you spent a year separated by self-will from alcohol. Were you proud of it, right? Right? Look at what I did, right? How cool is that, right? Look how good I am. So Roland, having this newfound confidence and this knowledge, you know, Carl Jung, this wonderful psychiatrist, gives him all this information. He's fully armed with the facts he believes. He hops on a train to head back from Austria to the Channel to get on a boat to go to England, to eventually get on a boat to come back to America. He doesn't get past Paris. He stops to have dinner with friends and gets drunk and gets back on the train, back to Austria, back to see Dr. Carl Jung, and Carl Jung is saddened. Because he was hopeful for Roland Hazard. Let's read on a little bit more. So he returned to this doctor whom he admired and asked him point blank why he could not recover. He wished above all things to regain self-control. He seemed quite rational and well-balanced with respect to other problems. Yet he had no control whatever over alcohol. Why was this? He begged the doctor to tell him the whole truth, and he got it. In the doctor's judgment, he was utterly hopeless. He could never regain his position in society and would have to place himself under lock and key to hire a bodyguard if he expected to live long. That was a great physician's opinion. That's going to be disappointing, isn't it? Some of our alcoholic readers may think they can do without spiritual help. Let us tell you the rest of the conversation our friend had with his doctor. The doctor said, "You have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. I have never seen one single case recover where the state of mind existed to the extent that it does in you. Our friend felt as though the gates of hell had closed on him with a clang." He said to the doctor, "Is there no exception?" "Yes," replied the doctor, "there is. Exception is such to cases such as yours have been occurring since early times. Here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have had what are called vital spiritual experiences." Now, he goes on to qualify this. To me, these occurrences are phenomena, right? So they're not typically happening, and they may be miraculous, which is the definition of phenomena. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements, ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding forces of the lives of these men, are suddenly cast to one side. and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. Now, this is key for my recovery. I don't know about you guys, but I have lived in a delusion where I have made a decision that I know what's right for me. I have figured out what's wrong with you, and I'm going to manage and control that situation or avoid it altogether. I'm going to deprive you of me. How sad is that, right? I'm going to do things to make my life better in my mind, right? Because I suddenly think I've had this knowledge and this idea of what will make me happy. The truth that I find out later in Alcoholics Anonymous is that all this is a delusion, and that all of what I have to do is exactly kind of the opposite of what I've been doing. Very disturbing to find out that I've been wrong my entire life. Very fortunate that I had the opportunity and the gift to find out just how wrong I was. In fact, I've been trying to produce some such emotional rearrangement within you. With many individuals, the method which I employed are successful, but I have never been successful with an alcoholic of your description. Upon hearing this, our friend was somewhat relieved, for he reflected that, after all, he was a good church member. This hope was destroyed by the doctor telling him that his religious convictions were very good, but that in his case, they did not spell the necessary vital spiritual experience. Here was a terrible dilemma in which our friend found himself when he had the extraordinary experience, which, as we have already told you, made him a free man. It's quite telling to me, and I've seen it. I mean, if you've been around Alcoholics Anonymous for a while, you've run into a preacher, you've run into a priest, you've run into a rabbi, you've run into a man with vast, or a woman with vast religious knowledge, who comes in and raises their hand and introduces themselves. I've met people who were far more intelligent than me in AA. Far more educated. Far more spiritual. Apparently it's not enough. Right? My knowledge combined with a religious experience isn't going to save my ass. Right? And when I talk to... And I've spent time with men of the cloth, you know, the answer is always, I have knowledge, but somehow I got lost. And I know that feeling because I got lost too. You know, I remember getting lost. I remember starting to have judgment and opinion when I was a young man about how these things would not work for me. And in getting lost, I so lost myself. And the only thing that seemed to work when I was lost was alcohol. We, in our turn, sought these same escapes. With all the desperation of drowning men, what seemed at first a flimsy reed has proved to be the loving and powerful hand of God. A new life has been given us, or, if you prefer, a design for living that really works. The distinguished American psychologist William James, in his book Varieties of Religious Experiences, indicates a multitude of ways in which men have found God. As a group, we have no desire to convince anyone that there is only one way by which God can be discovered. If what we have learned and felt and seen means anything at all, it means that all of us, whatever our race, creed, or color, are the children of a loving Creator with whom we may form a relationship upon simple and understandable terms as soon as we are willing and honest enough to try. Those having religious affiliations will find here nothing disturbing to their beliefs or ceremonies. There is no friction among us over such matters. We think it no concern of ours as a group what religious bodies our members identify themselves with as individuals. This should be an entirely personal affair which each one describes for himself in the light of past associations or his present choices. Not all of us have joined religious bodies, but most of us favor such memberships. In the following chapter, there appears an explanation of alcoholism as we understand it. Then a chapter addressed to the agnostic. Many who were once in this class are now among our members. Surprisingly enough, we find such convictions that no great obstacle to a spiritual experience. There is a group of personal narratives, and then clear-cut directions are given showing how an alcoholic may recover. These are followed by more than a score of personal experiences. Each individual in his personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he found or rediscovered God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what actually has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women desperately in need will see these pages, and we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that we'll be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them. I must have this thing.
Right.
I see, my name's Chris, I'm an alcoholic. I see people who have the regular big book, and if you're here for the first time, you might notice that some of the things that Dave is reading don't follow exactly the text of the big book. That's because we're reading from an original manuscript. And if you have this red book, the original manuscript is in the back. It's not in the front. There are some of the chapters only have subtle changes. Some of them have dramatic changes. But what we wanted to do is we wanted to go back to the earliest layer of the recovery experience and how it was presented by Bill and the first 70 or 80 alcoholics. What happened after the original manuscript was printed was it went to different people, and those people made corrective suggestions. So what happened was Bill took a lot of that, took a lot of those suggestions to heart, and changed it. So the big book is different from the original manuscript. But the original manuscript is what the alcoholics put together. The big book, as it stands today, is what was edited by doctors and priests and, you know, all kinds of people. So we thought it would be cool to do the original manuscript in this particular chapter. You know, the chapter that Dave was reading is There's a Solution. I will state this today. For some reason in contemporary Alcoholics Anonymous, the solution has become almost gray. It's almost a gray area. I'll mention that right now the biggest controversy on the recovery Facebook sites is the front page of the newest Grapevine. The front page of the newest Grapevine says, "Don't drink and go to meetings." Big book and recovery people have lost their friggin' mind over this because don't drink and go to meetings isn't a good thing to do. It's because so often people believe don't drink and go to meetings, just don't drink and go to meetings. If you're telling somebody to just go, don't drink and go to meetings, that's like telling somebody who's been in a terrible car accident with 14 broken bones to just go to the waiting room at the hospital. You know what I mean? It's really, really bad if it's perceived as a solution and not a good suggestion. So anyway, when Dave was going through There Is a Solution, you know, in that one brief paragraph where it talks, look, you may not want to do this. Nobody likes doing inventory. Nobody likes paying the money back. But if you don't do that, then you're not engaging in the Alcoholics Anonymous solution, because that's what the AA solution is. The AA solution is the 12 steps. It's become very, very comfortable in contemporary AA to sit in a chair and believe that you're going to get recovery through osmosis by sharing. That's so far from the truth, you cannot even believe it. There are people who have experienced the 12 steps, who've actually taken them, and there's not a one of them who would disagree with me. Because once you experience the recovery process by actually doing the steps, you are in that fourth dimension that Dave was reading about. It's a fourth dimension of recovery. It's about, you know, you're in a state of intuition, of consciously knowing, you know, knowing without conscious thought, knowing with, you know, just knowing that everything is all right. Now I'm going to start with more about alcoholism. This is chapter 3. Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his liquor or drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursued it to the gates of insanity and death. And that's because until I was in Alcoholics Anonymous for about 6 months, I didn't know what alcoholism was. You know, I vaguely perceived that alcoholism was drinking a lot. You know, but that's not really true. I had a roommate when I went down to college. I had a roommate who drank just like me. I'd drink a bottle of bourbon and he'd drink a bottle of rum. And we'd go crash cars and get thrown out of bars. We drank exactly the same. But he was not an alcoholic. When the time came for him, he met a girl And the time came, and he decided, you know, she might, you know, little what's her name doesn't really like me to be in a blackout drunk with Chris, you know, on the weekend. All of a sudden, I lost my drinking buddy, and he's fine, right? Not me. There was nothing that a Komatsu tractor couldn't have pulled me away from those bottles. I was alcoholic, and that was the number one thing in my life. And that's the difference. So drinking a lot of booze doesn't make you an alcoholic. The consequences of DUIs and going to treatment centers, that does not make you an alcoholic. What makes you an alcoholic is countless vain attempts to drink like normal people and finding out that you can't. That's a piece of alcoholism. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people or presently maybe had to be smashed. So they're telling us really what the first step is. And the first, they've explained in the doctor's opinion, and there is a solution, they've explained what alcoholism is. Alcoholism is basically three things. Alcoholism is once you put alcohol in your body, you create a phenomenon. It's called the phenomenon of craving. It's the allergy of alcohol. And it presents like this. The first drink always does something. And what that something is it asks for the second drink. And the second drink demands the third. And the third insists on the fourth. And you usually get tongue chew and knee walk and not able to operate your own pant zipper drunk. And that's normally what happens. Now the second piece of alcoholism is the mental obsession. And that's the countless vain attempts to drink like other people, or the countless vain attempts to quit drinking. And what it is, and it's an obsession of the mind. And how that presents is you have an utter inability to make a decision to stay away from alcohol and have that mean anything at all. You can write in the Bible, you can go to treatment, you can get detoxed 45 times. But if you haven't had a spiritual experience, you are going to continue to put alcohol in your body. That's what alcoholism is. And the third part of alcoholism is the unmanageability, the spiritual malady. And how that looks is, at best, restless, irritable, discontent. Normally, you know, prey to misery, depression, anxiety, self-centered fear, guilt, shame, remorse, just an utter inability to feel comfortable with yourself or your environment. And at worst, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And I'm not talking about when you're drinking, I'm talking about when you're not drinking. That's when that stuff presents. We don't do well, an alcoholic does not do well with sobriety. What happens is it becomes increasingly untenable. Without a spiritual change, without a personality shift, sobriety becomes increasingly untenable. I was watching Days of Wine and Roses years and years ago, and it's about two people who get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they fall in love, and they run off, and she relapses, and he doesn't. He continues to go to meetings and stay sober. And he's talking to her, and he's basically saying, well, you know, why? Why don't you want to get sober? And she says, because when I'm sober, everything is gray. Everything is just gray, and there's no excitement. It's just dull and dry. And that's at best for an alcoholic. You know, we just can't seem to enjoy sobriety. And listen, part of my meeting discipline for many, many years has been to go to a beginner's meeting. And if I had a dollar for everybody that's blown through that meeting, and normally what happens is they come out of treatment or they come out of the VA or they come out of detox and they show up in the beginner's meeting. And we have a temporary sponsor list, and we allow them to share. And then the second part of the meeting is people with a lot of time sharing their experience, strength, and hope. We're really trying to reach out and tell them a little bit about what alcoholism is and a little bit about what you need to do. 9 times out of 10, the people remain unconvinced that they need to get as busy as they need to get. They really think that they can just go to meetings and be able to take care of this problem. And I can't tell you the turnover rate in this meeting. Every single night, there's 5 or 6 people who are brand new. There's usually 7 or 8 people celebrating 90 days. And And if you disappear from that meeting for 6 months and you go back, the only people you'll see who you'll recognize are the people who've been going there for years, because everybody else is blown through. The recidivism, the recidivism in Alcoholics Anonymous is monstrously huge. You know, it is really easy to walk through that door. It is unbelievably, incredibly hard to stay here. It just doesn't happen. People just don't stay. And I truly believe that it's because they're not putting enough into Alcoholics Anonymous to get enough of an experience back to be able to stay. You know, if you don't have a shift in personality, if you don't start to feel better, there's not going to be any real reason to stay here. Sobriety is going to get untenable. Sobriety is going to get gray and miserable, and your emotional state's going to deteriorate, and you just stand sober one day at a time, you know, and it's just, you know, finally you're just not going to be able to take it. You're not going to be able to take it. And that's what happens with alcoholics. That's why these guys got busy. They got busy. In the early days of AA, it was not unusual to have somebody on amends by the end of the week. Somebody, when they walk right in drunk off the street, to have them on amends by the end of the week. I mean, that's how busy these guys got. These guys were in real trouble. They had to have a huge shift in their spiritual state. And that's what they would do. I'm not saying that's what we should do, folks. I think there's some wisdom in being a little more thorough and taking a little bit more time. But it's great to look back at what was going on in the early days. There were many meetings that if you weren't on amends, they didn't want you in the meetings because they didn't believe that you meant business, that you were serious. They didn't want to waste time with people who weren't going to go through these steps. And this is really our history. Alcoholics Anonymous is a much different animal today. And I'm not even saying it shouldn't be. I'm saying that every once in a while an alcoholic walks through those doors. And they're not going to be able to stay sober sitting in here and sharing about their day and being the cookie guy. It's just not going to work. You know, they're going to get drunk. And then they're going to go out and tell everybody AA doesn't work and give us a black eye when they didn't do AA. AA is the steps. It's not the meetings. AA is the steps. We alcoholics are men and women who have had lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovered this control. So once you're an alcoholic, you're always going to be an alcoholic. You're never going to be able to take alcohol into your system safely, even if they advertise a pill on late night TV. Okay? Because every once in a while you'll see that. Take one of these pills and you can drink two drinks normally. And my first thought is, I'll take six pills, I'll drink 12 drinks normally, everything's going to be great. Just because that's what an alcoholic is going to think. A heavy drinker, somebody who's gotten in trouble with a DUI or something, that pill might really work. I don't know. But it's not going to work if you're an alcoholic. All of us felt at times that we were regaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness over any considerable period of time. We get worse, never better. Now this is a warning. This is a very serious warning, because it doesn't say over any considerable period of time when we're drinking we get worse, never better. It says over any considerable period we get worse, not better. So alcoholism is getting worse while you're in recovery, while you're sitting here sober. Your alcoholism is getting worse. And how it's getting worse is your liver and your pancreas they weren't able to metabolize alcohol normally. That's why you get the craving to continue to drink and get blind drunk, you know, when you start drinking. That part of your physiology is going to continue to get worse. And you see this with people who've been sober for a period of time, and then they go out and they relapse. And they come back in and they said, "Oh my God, it was 10 times worse than it was when I came in the first time. Oh my God." You know, and that's because alcoholism progressed while they were staying sober, sharing, you know, for 5 years in the meetings. and now they're drunk, and it's just the monstrous debacle. We are like men who have lost their legs. They never grow new ones. Neither does there appear to be any kind of treatment which will make alcoholics of our kind like other men. We have tried every imaginable remedy. In some cases, there has been brief recovery followed always by still worse relapse. Physicians who are familiar with alcoholism agree that there is no such thing as making a normal drinker out of an alcoholic. Science may one day accomplish this, but it evidently hasn't done so yet. And I can tell you this, I stay very, very current with the science of addiction and addiction recovery and treatment and all of the addiction medications that are out there, from Suboxone to everything else. I stay pretty current on what they do and how they work. Vivitrol and all that stuff. You get a shot in the ass and opiates won't work for a month. I mean, there's all these types of drugs, and some of them are incredibly good if used as indicated. But there is nothing that will repair your liver and pancreas to the point where you can start to drink and not develop the craving once you've crossed that line. Despite all we can say, many who are real alcoholics are not going to believe that they are in that class. By every form of self-deception, experimentation, they will try to prove themselves exceptions to the rule, therefore non-alcoholic. If anyone who is showing inability to control his drinking can do the right about face and drink like a gentleman, our hats are off to him. Heavens knows we have tried hard enough and long enough to drink like other people. Listen, I've known people that have been in Alcoholics Anonymous a long time. And for one reason or another, they were put in here, you know, by well-meaning but very ignorant, you know, counselors or whatever, and after 5 or 10 years they just kind of learned enough about alcoholism to realize they really weren't alcoholics, and they've gone back out and they can drink normally and they've put their psychological issues, you know, to bed, and they're fine. That happens a lot. But you know, our hats are off to those people. My God, it's better to find out you're not an alcoholic than it is to find out you are. Alcoholism is a progressively fatal illness. If not put in remission through spiritual living, you're going to die a very pathetic death. We go out in really, really gruesome ways. You know what I mean? Cancer at least allows you the dignity of putting your affairs in order before you check out. Alcoholism does not. You usually check out and you're at the lowest point in your life. The few, you know, the people who love you either pity you or resent you at that point in time. You know, you're all alone usually when you check out with alcoholism. Here are some of the methods we've tried. Drinking beer only, limiting the number of drinks, never drinking alone, never drinking in the morning, drinking only at home, never having it in the house, never drinking during business hours, drinking only at parties, switching from scotch to brandy. I remember I switched from vodka to schnapps one time. Because I thought, how much goddamn schnapps can somebody drink, you know? This is going to have to help. Oh my God, you can drink a lot of schnapps. And I will tell you, it gets messy. You know what I mean? Holy mackerel. It's like drinking a pound of sugar or eating a pound of sugar. Oh, it's bad. Drinking only natural wines. I went on a beer thing for a while, you know, because I was drinking so much hard liquor. I go, I'll drink beer. That'll be good. And I started drinking 2 6-packs of 16-ounce Budweiser a night. I blew up like the Michelin Man. It was awful. Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of liquid to put down every night. Oh my God. Agreeing to resign if ever drunk on the job. Taking a trip. Not taking a trip. Swearing off forever and without a solemn oath. Taking more physical exercise. Reading inspirational books. Consulting psychologists. Going to health farms and sanitariums. Detoxes and rehabs. Accepting voluntary commitment to asylums. We're the only people that, you know, we voluntary commitments to asylums. I'm going to Happy Hills, Mike. You know, pick up the paper for me. I mean, you know, it's unbelievable. We can increase the list ad infinitum. Listen, I want to cover one thing, and I'm going to pass the ball back to Dave. Alcoholism is not causal. The people that treat us for alcoholism, there's a majority of them who want us to believe it's causal. They want us to believe that there's factors involved in us becoming alcoholic. They want to believe that by educating us on triggers, we'll be able to prevent our own relapse. Listen, there's a lot of people that believe all this stuff. But if this book is telling us the truth, if we suffer from a mental obsession that's going to ensure that we put alcohol back in our body, you know, self-knowledge is not going to help us. And so often people want to blame our alcoholism on something, or they want us to arrange our life in a certain way so that we're not tempted to drink. Now that's crazy. Let me just ask this question. Has anybody in here ever gotten drunk because they lost a job? Has anybody in here ever gotten drunk because they kept the job? Has anybody in here ever gotten drunk because she or he left? Has anybody in here gotten drunk because he or she stayed? Do you get what I'm saying? Getting drunk is not causal. It's not because of our situation or our outside stuff. It's because of an inner compulsion, a genetic inner compulsion to drink. This is much more, we're in much more trouble than a lot of people would like us to believe. A lot of people would like us to just arrange our lives. You know, don't drive by the liquor store on the way home from work anymore. You know, listen, good God. Listen, it's a much bigger problem than that. If we could just dodge and weave and stay sober, you know, that's we're not an alcoholic if we can do that. So again, what this book did in 1939 was... it gave a description of what alcoholism is. It put its finger on the problem, and it offered an incredibly in-depth solution to alcoholism that still works today. It's absolutely amazing, the process in this book. And there was no sugar coating in this original manuscript. It basically told you, if you are an alcoholic and you know, you don't follow these 12 steps of recovery, we're pretty sure that you're going to drink, and for us to drink is to die. It's basically what this book is saying. Nobody likes to hear bad news, but I'll tell you what, I would rather somebody, if I'm dying from an illness, and I believe alcoholism is an illness, if I'm dying from it, I would rather hear the goddamn truth, so that armed with those facts, I can either say, okay, I'm going to do these 12 steps, or okay, I'm not. You know, I'll understand that the choice is to go on to the better end, blotting out of my mind how miserable my life is, just drinking myself to death, or accepting spiritual help. I won't continue to look for door number C. And that's what so many alcoholics do. They try to find door number C. And you know what? That's why we see people relapsing through Alcoholics Anonymous like crazy, because there ain't no door number C. There's either continue on with active alcoholism, whether you're sober or drunk, there's untreated alcoholism, or accept spiritual help.
So I listened to Chris, right, and I listened to Chris talk about alcoholism, and I listened to Chris talk about the original manuscript, and I've heard Chris many times do an introduction to what alcoholism looks like, and I can guarantee you this, if he ended it with this, you're an alcoholic, I wouldn't listen to him anymore. Because I'm an alcoholic, and I have an immediate resentment capability. I have the immediate opportunity to begin to dislike you if you start to tell me things. Right, and up until now in this book, they've pieced it out for us in clear and concise ways. But now we're going to come to the point where they're going to let us have an opportunity to make our own decision about where we stand. Right? Because if you start to tell me what it is that's wrong with me, I'm going to stop listening to you. There's something about my delusion that wants to protect it from the facts delivered to me in a straightforward manner. I've got to somehow make it my own idea. I've got to somehow go, you know what, you're right. Yes, you are right. I see that now. It's all clear. Waking up with that transvestite in the hotel room with the police knocking on the door was a tad out of the ordinary for leaving the business party. I think you're correct in that. But if you told me that was weird, I would say, no, that's what I was doing that night. You know? Well, Phil was there. I mean, what can I tell you? So
just
I
one of those things.
Just one of those things. There was no midgets or donkeys, so I can tell you it was okay. I have a natural inclination to disregard what you tell me because I'm tired of listening to you because you don't understand. If you understood, you'd drink the way I drank. Now, imagine this. You're an alcoholic, and you're giving me a message of death away, but you then turn to me and tell me something. I will pick on the things in your story that are different than mine, so I have the right to refuse what you're telling me. I can't get with God unless I'm willing to get without myself, and I can't get without myself if you tell me to do it. There's a natural inability for me to listen. I'm going to defend the indefensible for as long as humanly possible. Now, there's a set of directions in the book. There's a set of directions in the original manuscript. I don't particularly use this set of directions, but it's there. Well, we do not like to brand any individual as an alcoholic, but you can quickly diagnose yourself. Step over to the nearest bar room and try some controlled drinking. Try to drink and stop abruptly. Try it more than once. It will not take you long to decide. If you are honest with yourself about it, it will be worth a bad case of jitters if you get thoroughly sold on the idea that you are a candidate for Alcoholics Anonymous. Mm-hmm. I can tell you this, that nowadays, when I think about the tort law and the potential for legal lawsuits, if I tell you to go drink, I am reluctant. Maybe I'm not connected to God, or maybe I'm just using God's gift of my brain. Right? But the truth is that when I came in here in 1985 in the back of the worst imaginable, in my mind, chemical bottom, I wasn't ready yet. I had to come on here in the back of an incredibly hard spiritual bottom to be ready. And this is a twofold disease, right? The phenomenon of craving and the mental obsession. I had to end up back here spiritually broken in order to get it. You know, I had to go return to that bar room to try some more controlled drinking. And that's exactly what it was that time around. Though there is no way of proving it, we believe that early in our drinking careers, most of us could have stopped drinking. But the difficulty is that few alcoholics have enough desire to stop while there is yet time. I think they're being nice to us there. We have heard a few instances where people who showed definite signs of alcoholism were able to stop because of an overpowering desire to do so. Here is one. So we're going to talk about the man of 30, which is a great story because it reminded me very much of me. But that paragraph is interesting for me because there's a lot of people, you hang around Alcoholics Anonymous long enough, you hear a lot of people talk about like having gone to high school and then college and then maybe an advanced degree and getting a family, you know. I ended up under a bush at 18. I don't think I had the ability to stop at any point in my life, you know. But that doesn't separate me from those who could, right? Those who got separated. A man of 30 was doing a great deal of spree drinking. He was very nervous in the morning after these bouts and quieted himself with more liquor. He was ambitious to succeed in business but saw that he could get nowhere if he drank at all. Once he started, he had no control whatever. He made up his mind that until he had been successful in business and had retired, he would not touch another drop. An exceptional man, he remained bone dry for 25 years and retired at the age of 55 after a successful and happy business career. Then he fell victim to a belief, which practically every alcoholic has, that his long period of sobriety and self-discipline had qualified him to drink as other men. Out came his carpet slippers and a bottle. In 2 months, he was in a hospital, puzzled and humiliated. Why do we always end up humiliated? Isn't that, you know, why can't we end up happy or something, you know, or in shape, you know? Or why do we end up humiliated? That's the nature, isn't it?
Come out of a blackout running a charity drive.
Yeah.
Okay. Never happened.
Never happened. You've never heard that, right? You come out of a blackout and you look around and you don't recognize anyone except for the police officer. Yeah. What the hell did you just tell him? Anyway. And I lost my spot. Out came his carpet slippers in a bottle. In 2 months, he was in a hospital, puzzled and humiliated. He tried to regulate his drinking. I tried that for a while, making several trips to the hospital in the meantime. Then, gathering all his forces, he attempted to stop and found he could not. Every means of solving his problem, which money could buy, was at his disposal. Every attempt failed. Though a robust man at retirement, he went to pieces quickly and was dead within 4 years. My experience was 17 years separated from a chemical bottom, and probably about 9 of those not involved in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, unless I was on vacation, in which case I'd check out the local AA meeting just to see what you guys did in Aruba or Paris or London or Canton, Ohio, or some of the hot spots on the international tour. And what ended up happening was I thought that I could manage and control this because I started, every other aspect of my life looked normal. And I've never read The Man of 30 prior to coming back in 2004. When I read The Man of 30, I said, I know how this guy feels. That somehow, some level of discipline, which I don't believe in my case was discipline, I believe was the grace of God, right? But some level of discipline would separate me long enough that it would be okay if I returned to drinking. The definition of my alcoholism is an inability to drink successfully and an inability to inability to stay stopped. That is the definitive description of what alcoholism looks like in my life. I get there on the back of a horrendous mental obsession that some of you people are doing something to harm me, or something's going wrong in this world, or that something is going quite well. When I drank again in 2002, the world was fine. Right? There was nothing wrong except internally I was dying. I understand The Man of 30, and I once had the great pleasure of giving somebody a coin out in Pennsylvania, and I went out to speak at her home group for her anniversary, and I gave her coin, we had a great time, and then they asked me to speak, and I started speaking, and I was speaking, and nobody was laughing. You know, and I told some funny stories. You know, you tell some funny, the bad taste stories in Alcoholics Anonymous are the funny ones, right? Stuff you can't tell at the bar mitzvah. You know, gets us laughing here. And I'm telling all these stories, and then I talk about the bitter old, semi-flammable old timer who hasn't done the work, right? And they all start to laugh, and I look around and I go, "You've got some here, don't you?" And they all go, "Yes, we do." And they were sitting in the back judging me. You know, the people in the back had been in alcoholics long enough to think that they had a solution or had an idea of what a solution looked like, and they were doing absolutely nothing to grow their spiritual experience. And what they were finding out was that Alcoholics Anonymous was annoying them. That if somebody showed up and talked about doing the steps, if somebody showed up talked about having a spiritual awakening, it made them uncomfortable enough that they had to decide that there was something wrong with that person. And what I had been doing for 25 minutes was literally talking about all the things that they refused to talk about when that meeting was an open discussion meeting. And everybody was sitting there nervous. What were the old timers going to do? Well, mm-hmm. I don't know what the old timers are going to do, right? But I know that I became a bitter, dry alcoholic, and in that time when I became prepared, right, to take my retirement, so to speak, it didn't work. And it doesn't work because alcoholism doesn't give me the respect I deserve. It doesn't give me the dignity to allow it for me to control it. For some reason, it ends up controlling me, and for some reason, it takes me to places I don't want to go, and I don't have any control over that. Chris, you have anything you want to say? You want to wrap it up?
We can wrap it up.
All right. So I think that we're going to, if I'm not mistaken, we're going to go into a Jim next, right? Or is it Fred?
Our friend Jim.
Our friend Jim. So I think next week we're going to return after the anniversary and go into our friend Jim. So with that, I'm going to open it up to comments, queries.